Well, hello everyone. You're listening to Moboco Audio. Our podcast today focuses on supporting students with the brain and mind. The episode offers a helpful theoretical frame for Dan Siegel's whole brain theory, and then serves up five key strategies to support students' brain integration so they don't, quote, flip their lids. Hopefully you'll come away with a better understanding of whole brain theory and have some strategies that'll make you feel more successful when you're working with students who have difficulty self-regulating. Now our guest today is child and youth care practitioner, behavior specialist, Sonia Radmilovic. I've enjoyed her presentation so much that I really wanted to chat with her one-on-one about her work and its application in school settings. Sonia, thank you so much for getting together.
Thank you, Chris. I'm excited to have this opportunity. One of my additional roles, and perhaps most important one, is as a parent to two beautiful children, a teen daughter and an 11-year-old son. I add this because these whole brain strategies have saved me on many occasions in my parenting role.
That is such an important connection to make at the outset, for although you're a professional behavior specialist, you are also a parent who has to apply these very strategies in your daily life as a mom. In fact, you know, your ability to relate on that very human level is one of the things I appreciate so much about your work. Before we begin, I want to check in. Because of COVID-19, we've been working remotely for the past 6 weeks, and I know you to be such a connecting person where you thrive on the face-to-face personal relationship that you have with people. So I'm wondering, Sonia, how are you actually doing?
Honestly, in the first week or so of COVID-19, when BC started to get the message that we were to isolate at home, I went into fight, flight, or freeze mode in the downstairs brain, as Dan Siegel calls it, and we'll cover that later in this podcast. As you noted, I connect and thrive on face-to-face interaction. Biologically, we are all social beings, yet all of a sudden, we were directed to stay at home and to isolate from others. This was a scary unknown experience, and I could physically feel it in my body. I became reactive, I was tense, tired, and noticed that I was not breathing from my diaphragm. However, I was able to name it to tame it, practice self-compassion, and ultimately acceptance, which were strategies to keep me in my upstairs brain. So after that intentional self-reflection and practice, I am doing great.
Well, I'm glad you're surviving, and it sounds like you're actually thriving. I'm so excited that we're together today because there is so much to your work on this topic that I want to know more about, including the five strategies, which I understand are connect and redirect, name it to tame it, engage, don't enrage, use it or lose it, move it or lose it. Have I got those right?
There are actually 12 strategies. However, I chose the five strategies that were most applicable to teachers in a busy classroom with 20 to 25 students. I wanted to ensure the strategies were easy to apply and easy to remember. Plus, I do a lot of these presentations during lunch, which we know is only 45 minutes.
Okay, yeah, I forgot about that. All right, why don't we dive into this? So who is Dan Siegel, and how did you get interested in his whole brain theory work?
Dan Siegel is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and a renowned, respected author. Some of his books are Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, No Drama Discipline, The Yes Brain, The Whole Brain Child, among many others. I have known about Dan Siegel's work for about 10 years now. When I was a team leader in child and youth mental health, we used his whole brain child strategies in our work with families. When I transitioned to the education field, I recognized that his work was equally relevant and applicable in our work with students. I particularly like how he takes complex scientific concepts and makes them accessible to all us lay people, and he does so with compassion and kindness, knowing and expressing that parents and educators want to do their very best with kids. I also saw him at a conference in Anaheim where I developed a little professional crush on him because he was so articulate, eloquent, and kind. Plus, the nerd in me is just so intrigued by his work in interpersonal neurobiology, which is awesome. A relatively new field.
That's awesome. Now, you often begin your presentations by inviting participants to share how students' behavior really is a form of communication. Can you explain that more for me and how that relates to Siegel's brain theory?
Well, I ask teachers to give me examples of behaviors that communicate their students are having a hard time. They describe students who put their heads on their desk, refuse to do work, crawl under tables, run out of the classroom, throw things, rip things off the wall, rip up other students' work, just to name a few.
Yeah, just a few.
These behaviors indicate that the different parts of their brain are not working together. They're just not integrated. It's like our physical body. All of our organs perform different jobs, but for the body to be healthy, they have to work as a whole in an integrated manner.
Right.
Integration coordinates and balances the separate regions of the brain that it links together.
Okay, I see. Now, Sonia, you used the term integration there. How does this concept of integration fit into brain theory?
Dan takes the complicated brain and divides it into the left and right brain and upstairs and downstairs brain. In real simple terms, the left brain is logical, linear, linguistic, and literal, whereas the right brain reads the nonverbals, it senses information and emotions from the brain, and can put things in context and see the whole picture. When these two parts of the brain are integrated, they work together as a whole. Whenever these two parts of the brain work together, they create and reinforce the integrative fibers that link different parts of the brain. If just one side was running the show, we would see a lack of integration or disintegration. For example, if the left brain was running the show, we would see no flexibility and just rigidity in behavior. Whereas if the right side of the brain was running the show, feelings and emotions would flood the person and we would see chaos. Integration facilitates wellness, which Dan calls the river of well-being.
I love that. The place we're all searching for. Okay, I understand the idea of left brain, right brain integration, but help me now to better understand the idea of the upstairs, downstairs brain and how that fits into integration.
I'm so glad you asked me this question, Chris. Remember when I said at the beginning of this podcast that I was in my downstairs brain?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thankfully, my downstairs brain never fully took over. I'm sure my family is grateful for that.
I'm sure they are.
But let me pry it apart a bit. The downstairs brain is really the reptilian brain. It's been with mankind since the beginning of time. It houses the limbic system, which is responsible for instinct, reacting, and impulse. It tells the body to ramp up the hormones such as adrenaline and cortisol, which help us to fight, flight, or freeze. It controls the basic emotions, fear, pleasure, anger, and our drives, like hunger, sex, dominance, and care of our offspring. The upstairs brain, the cerebral and more specifically prefrontal cortex, evolved later in mankind's history. It's responsible for our decision-making, planning, self-control, self-understanding, and empathy, morality, and executive functioning.
Okay.
When there's a lack of integration between the upstairs and downstairs brain, we witness this in students' behavior and some adults as well. Extreme incidents of road rage, for example, is the downstairs brain running the show. In students whose downstairs brain is running the show, we see them in flight or freeze or fight. Stress hormones flood their body and interfere with the functioning of their upstairs brain, and they lose control over their body and emotions. This is really stressful for them and the adults working with them. At this point, the student is incapable of making choices or being reasoned with. For example, I work with a grade one student who runs out of the school and all the way home when he's in his downstairs brain. When he is in this stage, all the staff can do is follow him because he really can't be reasoned with. He has effectively flipped his lid.
Right. Okay, that totally makes sense. Now, Siegel's handy hand model is such a visual and effective one for people to grasp. Can you summarize it for me and perhaps talk a little bit about why it's such a useful metaphor in your presentations?
This is the fun part. I'm a really big fan of the handy model because it is so accessible to kids and adults alike.
It is.
So, everybody listening, make a fist with your hand, tuck your thumb under your fingers, rest your elbow on the table with the fist facing you. The forearm is the spinal cord. The wrist is the base of the skull. The thumb is the limbic system. The fingers hugging the thumb are the cerebral and prefrontal cortex. Remember, the prefrontal cortex is typically the part of the brain that is guiding our daily behavior.
Right, I remember.
Now, lift your fingers off your thumb, pointing them straight up into the air. This is called flipping your lid because the cortex is no longer integrated with the limbic system.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer connected.
Mm.
This is when the downstairs brain is running the show. So when you teach this hand model to students and kids, They say and do things like, "Miss R, I'm feeling like my lid is going to flip," as they wiggle their fingers a bit. Once you have a student able to identify this, they're starting to build awareness of their body sensations and their thoughts. Right. And this is the best time to teach them strategies.
All right. Well, that totally makes sense. Thank you for that, Sonia. Now, I want to shift gears a bit here and focus on how what we've been talking about connects to learning in the classroom. Now, I've heard you say that, quote, social emotional learning is typically experiential. It is a felt experience first, then the cognitions happen. It is rarely linear, end quote. Help me to understand what you mean by this and what are the implications for this for classroom people?
Experiential learning is really a fancy term for learning through doing and reflection. Learning about social relationships and how to manage one's big feelings is initially learned through play and experience. The reflection part is guided by a safe, consistent, caring, and trusting adult. First instances of it occur between the parent and child. We learn about ourselves and others in relationships. We read the nonverbals and feel the body sensations with our right brain and then label it with our left brain. In fact, we get a gut feeling or heartfelt sense from our right brain. Social emotional learning is not linear. Students don't go from hitting their peers to not hitting their peers in a straight line of progress. Right. Instead, it is a messy, curvy line and progress often stalls or even regresses.
Nice way to explain it.
One whole week, the student might not hit his peers, but then all of a sudden, he or she may hit his peers again. This regression should never be seen as failure, rather just a temporary stall. After all, most behavior change happens this way. I really think that's the implication for school personnel and parents, knowing that just because a student was able to do it one time or do it before doesn't mean he or she will be able to always do it. Therefore, as the adults, we need to continue to provide the structure and the plan for them to be successful.
Okay, that totally makes sense when you explain it that way, Sonia. Thank you. Now, why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we can dive into the 5 strategies to prevent kids from flipping their lids. Hey, podcast listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to MoboCo Audio. I want to let you know that if you're enjoying this episode on Whole Brain Theory with Sonia Gredin-Milovic, you might also enjoy downloading the MoboCo Audio episodes featuring Carla Braber. Carla shares her work around attachment and strategies for reconnection. These are available on podbean.com or from the MoboCo Audio podcast page at moboco.weebly.com. Well, we're back, and I'm speaking with Sonia Gredin-Milovic on the topic of supporting students with the brain and mind. Thanks again, Sonia, for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for interviewing me, Chris. I'm really having so much fun.
Now, I hope to spend the rest of our conversation digging into the 5 strategies: connect and redirect, name it to tame it, engage, don't enrage, use it or lose it, move it or lose it. Now, when students are upset, you recommend that we don't command and direct. Why is that?
When children and students are upset, the command and demand direction won't work until we have responded to the right brain's emotional need. In fact, command and demand doesn't work at the best of times. Does it work for you in your relationships, Chris?
Oh, yeah. It's my go-to strategy, actually. And no, it's not one that I found to be hugely successful.
So instead, we need to connect and then redirect. In the case of an upset student, we need to acknowledge their feelings in a non-judgmental way, use a nurturing tone of voice, empathetic facial expression, and get down to their level.
Can you give me a concrete example of what that might look like?
For an example, when a student becomes upset at cleanup time, maybe they'll throw a toy, refuse to clean up, and then lay on the ground in defiance. Mm-hmm. A connect and redirect response would sound and look like getting down to the child's level and softly saying with a kind facial expression, "I know you love building with Lego and you're building such a beautiful tower. I've got a great idea about how we can show your mom your Lego tower. Let's take a picture and put it on Fresh Grade."
Great idea.
Once the teacher has connected to the right brain, she can then use the left brain logic to direct. "Okay, we've now taken the picture, so it's time to start putting things away. Let me help you start."
Well, that very much makes sense. Now, that's not always easy to do, is it?
we really have to resist the natural inclination to explain the need to do something. In our society, we are trained to use our words and logic to solve problems, but kids are just not there developmentally yet. Even adolescents aren't there. Dan gives a funny example of when his 13-year-old was feeling hurt because it seemed to him that his sister was receiving preferential treatment. Dan's response wasn't to scoff at his son's feelings and get out the scorecard showing that he reprimanded each of his children in equal measure. No, he knew that that wouldn't work.
No. That's good. Okay, I just love that. I can imagine Dan actually pulling out a score chart and sort of licking the pencil and walking his children through, you know, who had what points when and who got reprimanded when. Now, I hear what you're saying here, but I wonder if we can get it wrong despite our attempts to connect and redirect authentically in these challenging moments, particularly, you know, if we're feeling frustrated ourselves or we're tired or we really want to keep a lesson moving along for the sake of the other students. What are your thoughts about that?
I think anytime someone tries to authentically attune and connect to an upset child, to really be present, even if they get the emotion wrong, like the student is not sad or upset, rather just tired, nonetheless, the adult will have helped the student build integration in the brain and help the student calm down. The adult becomes someone who is safe and trustworthy to the student. However, where adults can sometimes go wrong is when, as you noted, their own feelings get in the way of connection. When I ask hardworking, conscientious teachers what keeps them from connection, they always say, my lesson plan, my to-do list, my own feelings of frustration and feelings of being judged by others.
Honest.
These internal teacher scripts or states get in the way of attunement and connection, just as they do for parents. Many a times I have missed an opportunity for connection with my son who was resisting soccer because all I saw was the need to get him out the door to arrive on time for practice.
Oh, I appreciate your honesty and your humanity, the professional and the mom all in one. Very humble. Well, that's such an important point to make, Sonia. Thanks for that. And what I understand from that is that there's more to just using the words of connecting. We adults really need to be self-aware in the process, manage our tone of voice, our facial and physical expression. And that's not easy to do, of course, given everything that you've said and everything that's going through a teacher's mind as they're trying to manage the day. But in other words, we need to authentically, mindfully engage in these moments. So, but that's going to be hard work, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is very hard work. But the work is always hard when dealing with students' feelings and behavior. Not only do we have to help them manage their own big feelings, but we have to self-regulate. So we have a choice. We can choose to deal with student behavior in its early stages at the beginning of an incident, maybe when it's just percolating, or we can respond to their behavior after it's exploded because of all their unmet needs. Either way, we are spending the time.
That's so true and such an important point to make. The second strategy you share with people is called name it and tame it. Can you explain this one a little bit for me?
Connect and redirect and name it to tame it are strategies to support right and left brain integration. When a student experiences a difficult, painful, even scary moment, it can be really overwhelming with big feelings and body sensations that flood their right brain. And here we witness chaos, just as we discussed earlier. In order to bring in the left brain's logic to help the student understand the experience, we still need to connect and attune. Then we encourage the student to tell the painful experience and help them along the way by naming their emotions. For example, I was observing the cutest little K student during recess. I noted that he and another little K student were throwing rocks at each other. My student got hit by a rock in the arm, and then he picked up a rock and threw it back at the other student, hitting him in the head. My K student started crying uncontrollably, running towards me, and then leapt into my arms as I was crouching down. He told me his story in a quivery voice about how the rock hit him first, and then he threw the rock hard, and it hit his friend in the head, and he said, "My brain just got so mad, and I didn't mean to hurt my friend. Please don't tell my mom." So while he was telling me his story, I was really leaning in and helping him name some of his feelings. Oh, that must have been scary when your brain got so mad.
You sound worried about your friend, but I think he's okay with the other teacher. Mm. We're going to have the chance to make this right with your friend.
Mm. Naming it.
Now, this might seem obvious, Chris, but I have witnessed many adults saying, instead, you know you shouldn't be throwing rocks.
Right.
Now you are going to lose recess.
Right.
This response does not serve to teach and support any social emotional learning or brain integration.
So this strategy is really a lot about reframing and honoring a student's immediate experience as a way of facilitating that de-escalation of emotions and helping them cognitively to connect their feelings with vocabulary. Have I got that right?
Yes. But the reframing is for the adults to consider moving from a mindset that may think this student's behavior is for attention to a mindset that thinks this behavior is because their brain is not integrated. Whereas the honoring a student's experience and helping them name their emotion actually squirts soothing neurotransmitters through the student's body that will help them calm down. That's why it's called name to tame.
Okay, good. I think I've got that. Now let's talk about strategy three, which is engage, don't enrage. Now I'm smiling as we get to this one because I'm thinking about the Bowie song, Putting Out Fire with Gasoline, which might be a perfect accompaniment song about what not to do. Yet it's so hard to not fall into doing when one is feeling tired or overwhelmed.
Yes, that's the perfect song to illustrate this principle. In fact, this basic principle, don't be the trigger, is now popping up in all crisis intervention models.
Really?
It's nice to know that there is a science behind it.
Very true.
This strategy and the next two are integrating the upstairs and downstairs brain, building the staircase between the two. This strategy works best when you have a relationship with a student and you're aware of his or her triggers, and that whenever possible, the upstairs brain is engaged to avoid enraging the downstairs brain. I'll give you an example.
Oh, great.
One of the students I work with really struggles with change or new things in his schedule. Initially, he would shout out to the teacher, "I hate you. I hate school." Now, the teacher could enrage the downstairs brain by saying, "Please don't say that to me. That's unacceptable."
Right.
Instead, she worked on saying, "Yes, change can feel hard when you expected something else to happen." Mm.
So she named it for the student.
Exactly. You can be upset, but maybe we could be a problem solver and think of another idea. He was intrigued and asked, "What can I do?"
Mm.
This strategy worked because it engaged the upstairs brain. Yes, the strategy took a few tries, and it required that the teacher not personalize the student's behavior. When the student was calm, she talked about what other words he could use to describe his emotions and feelings instead of "I hate you and I hate school."
Okay, the fourth strategy, use it or lose it, gets us back to the work we need to do to actively engage students in their brain processes. And that example you just used is such a good segue into this. Can you tell me more about this one?
This strategy basically involves us supporting our students to exercise their upstairs brain because it's like a muscle. When it gets used, it gets stronger. Teachers are excellent at this. I see teachers start this process in their kindergarten classes when they give students some responsibility in decision making. For example, when they give them a choice about what classroom chore to do or how to solve a problem. As much as they can, teachers resist solving problems for their students and rescuing them. They start to give them the problem-solving framework and support them to use it. Teachers also start teaching kids how to control their emotions and body and help them build empathy, morality, and self-understanding through all the social-emotional learning curriculum. The core competencies in the new curriculum is so connected to this strategy, which just makes me thrilled. Self-evaluation is part of building a sense of self. Both my kids have brought home many self-evaluations in the form of social-emotional learning and responsibility.
Yeah, it's great that that's embedded in our curriculum. Now, for strategy five, move it or lose it, you encourage school people to establish a mind-body connection for students as a means to facilitate this regulation. Can you describe why this is important and how you can activate it in a school setting?
Yes, well, research shows that when we change our physical state through movement or relaxation, for example, we can change our emotional state. Body movement impacts brain chemistry.
Oh, tell me more about this.
I see brilliant examples of some teachers using movement breaks in their classrooms all day long.
What does that look like?
Sometimes the breaks are going for a run when the student is feeling frustrated,
right,
or go to the hopscotch outside, or go skip rope. Any body movement can be incorporated into student schedules.
Mm-hmm.
For example, with the student that was able to say with his wiggly fingers that he was going to flip his lid,
right, I remember.
His movement strategy is to go shoot a few hoops. These body movement breaks are never contingent on good behavior. Rather, they are just used to build the staircase between the downstairs and upstairs brain to improve integration, thereby growing self-regulation capacity.
Okay, I got that. Now, Sonia, one additional aspect of your presentation work that I appreciate so much is how you activate participants' own thinking about how they will commit to adapting their practice to incorporate this brain research approach to responding to children with regulation challenges. Now, I don't mean to be cheesy, but can you imagine you are speaking directly to your audience now? What would you invite them to do as they leave our podcast and contemplate the next steps when they return to their schools?
Well, Chris, I really believe that in order to integrate new learning, we have to try to apply it relatively quickly in our practice. So I like to invite the teachers that I present to think about what they will do to integrate this new learning into their practice. So I ask them to spend a few minutes talking to their partner about what they'll do differently. Then I hand out heart post-it notes and ask them to write it on the post-it note. And then I ask them to post it on their desk.
As a little reminder. Neat. Well, Sonia, I've really enjoyed our time together today. Thank you so much for taking the time to share Dan Siegel's whole brain theory work with us. But more importantly, thank you for putting his work into a practical 5-strategy framework for school people to incorporate into their classroom practice. Now, before we sign off, I want to give you a bit of space to share any parting words that you'd love your listeners to hear today.
Well, Chris, as I said before, either we spend the time growing and developing students' social and emotional capacity through our connection, empathy, and our understanding of their attachment and brain needs, or we spend the time dealing with the behavior caused by all their unmet needs. Either way, we spend the time.
Well, that was my conversation with Sonia Radmilovic. Now, if you'd like to dive deeper into Sonia's work, you can follow her on Twitter or check out her contact links on the MobileCo website under the podcast page. Well, that's it for this episode of MobileCo Audio. My name is Chris. Thanks for joining us.